Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 687. My name is Camden Busey. I'm once again here in Grays Lake, Illinois at our Reformed Forum studio. Got a great episode, good conversation lined up for you today. We're excited to welcome to the program for the very first time as a panelist, we have Reverend Jeremy Boothby, of course, who's pastor of Christ Covenant Presbyterian Church in Amarillo, Texas. Welcome back, Jeremy. It's good to see you this side of things. How you doing?
Good to see you too, and I'm glad to be here with you brothers and looking forward to a great episode.
Yeah, we got a lot of feedback, a tremendous amount of good, solid feedback on your episode on Hebrews. We're looking at 1689 baptism and covenant theology that is in Hebrews and all the federal aspects of things there. So encourage people to get back in the archive and listen to that and continue to write in if you've got more follow-up and feedback, and we'll continue working on that. So appreciate your contributions there, Jeremy. And we're looking forward to having you discuss a new book with the author of that book. We're very pleased to welcome to the program today Dr. Benjamin Glad, who is Associate Professor of New Testament at Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. Welcome to the program, Ben. It's so good to see you.
So good to be here. I thank you guys for your time.
You bet. We had this in mind for quite some time and looking forward to discussing with you today specifically this new book from IVP, From Adam and Israel to the Church, A Biblical Theology of the People of God. This is in the ESBT series, which is based on the typical series people might see over my shoulder if they're watching the video. The old Biblical Theology series from IVP, and the one over my shoulder there is for the Temple and the Church's Mission, of course, by Dr. Beal, and this book is carrying on some of the initial work done in that volume. So we're going to be opening this up today, but there's a couple things, even a preamble maybe before our episode. I'd love to give you an opportunity to speak, Ben. We know we've been speaking in advance, even before recording and getting some details and updates about your family situation. But on Theology Simply Profound, Bob and Rob were able to lift you and your family up in prayer. We know you had a house fire on Thanksgiving, and I'd like to give you an opportunity or a moment at least just to mention that to the wider listenership and let everyone know how you're doing.
Hey, thank you so much, Camden. We're doing great. I'm in a rental house. This is a bedroom in our rental house. I do own that vacuum, though. Yeah, it's great.
We love it.
It's great. What's funny is that I had bought this Dyson vacuum right before, like a week before Thanksgiving. Got it at a killer deal, Walmart refurbished.
Yeah, that's when we got ours,
Killer deal. And of course, a week later, so we don't really have much stuff left, but I did buy a new vacuum cleaner. That's a big deal. Yeah, so on Thanksgiving Day we had a house fire, and so we lost the house is still standing, but everything inside of it's gone. HVAC is gone, the walls are gone, furniture is gone. The only clothes that we have are the ones that we wore to that day, and total loss. We had out of all of our stuff, 99.999% is gone. We have about 10 boxes left that were in the attic. And the reason why those were okay is because they were sealed in a plastic container. So my advice is to, take pictures. I sound like an insurance guy or whatever, but take pictures, take video of all your junk. Because if something happens, you're not going to be able to recreate it from your memory. We have so much stuff in the West. It's really sort of a tragedy in any case. Yeah. So we lost everything. We're totally safe. Kids are safe. We didn't have any pets. So, we're good there. It's going to be until probably, August, September, by the time we get in there, and this is like week 12 right now.
Wow.
So it's going to be a long road. We know that we're okay. Everybody's been so gracious to us. We really, so people give us, it's funny. So like we move into a rental, we finally get a kitchen back and the oven doesn't work. So it's like, of course, why should we be able to create food again? So week, again, we only have like 10 boxes of stuff left. And so, somebody stole some of our stuff out of those boxes. You know, and we're like, well, I guess God really doesn't want us to have anything.
Oh, so, man.
You know, it just, you know, we, some of the hits keep coming, but it's fine. We're, you know, insurance will take care of us, and it's okay. I mean, it's just stuff. You know, I mean, I've got a job, I've got my family, we have our health, we have our church. So, you know, I think we're hanging in there okay. So
praise the Lord.
Your concern.
Yeah, we're glad to hear that that you're doing well. And of course, nobody wants to go through that, and nobody thinks it'll happen to them, most likely. But thank you.
Never.
That the Lord is continuing to provide for you and your family, and look forward to the day and get back in your house. My goodness.
It's a weird thing. Like, you, it's not really the stuff. You just miss home. I think that's what's hard, right? Is you, it's not the stuff that you miss. It's, you just miss the environment and just home. Like, this isn't our home. And so I think my kids really feel that. I know my wife feels that. It's not our home.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, there's some real biblical themes there in terms of
having
a heritage and a land and a place, you know, looking for city that has foundations. So on that point, you know, we're talking some real heavy duty biblical theology here. Love the themes in this. So much of what you're doing in this book overlaps with the things we do here at Reform Forum week in and week out. But even before we talk about that book, back on episode 675, I think it was, I was speaking with your advisor, your colleague, Dr. Greg Beal, about his book on redemptive reversals, ironies in Scripture. But he was also able to provide a little bit of an intro to this wonderful book, A Story Retold, a Biblical Theological Introduction to the New Testament, co-authored by G.K. Beal and our guest today, Ben Glad. We got to do a whole episode on this, but I might as well, you know, certainly want to give you an opportunity to speak about this, because this is something special. I mean, obviously, the book today too, but I mean, this isn't the kind of book we talk about very often. This is a textbook, and this is something that we hope will last for many, many years to come. Can you tell us a bit about this, and maybe we can drum up some good sales?
At the very least, Camden, and Jeremy, I don't know if you have a copy too, but at least feels good. I think IVP did such a good job producing it.
Oh, yeah. And it's got that textbook paper.
Right. So that's the highest. It's a glossy paper.
Yeah.
It's a very heavy book. In fact, there's been some shipping issues where the books are so heavy that it's causing shipping problems. So if the box is dropped, like, a couple of the books get damaged because they're so heavy.
Well, they have a kavod. I mean, there's an OT joke.
I guess that's a good way to put it. That's funny. when Bob Yarbrough received the text, received that volume, he emailed me and Greg, and he goes, I picked it up and it has quite a fetching heft to it. He's so funny.
I didn't read that in the blurbs. I saw some other things that were mentioned.
That in the verb. Yeah,
fetching heft?
No. That was the private, the fetching heft. And so, you know, that's been a dream of mine, really, for ever since when I graduated Wheaton and I finished there. I graduated in 2008 and I immediately started teaching undergrad there at Wheaton, a freshman, sophomore, these NT survey courses. And I immediately was like, well, what textbook do I use? And so I started looking at some of the textbooks, and I didn't really like many of them because I want to do old and the new. I want to do biblical theology, redemptive history, book by book, and nobody does that. And so I was like, And so I asked Greg and I said, hey, what do you think about doing this? I was a nobody. I had just published my dissertation, but still, I mean, you know, I'm 27 years old or however. And I was like, nobody's going to take on this project for me, but if I can, you know, get some support from a senior scholar, I think we could do it. So he's like, oh, sounds great. You write it and I'll read it. So I was like, okay. So it's just how it comes with the territory. So I wrote about 90% of it, and I gave it to him. And so he made comments, and his comment, I mean, there are some amazing stories just even in that. It's a funny that I got it. How many times? This is a good story. And he probably forgot about it. This is an amazing story.
Well, let's get it on tape.
And,
go ahead.
And there's a lesson in here. This is the crazy story. So he has to read through the volume, the whole thing, start to finish. And we had to get it to the publisher on Monday. To meet a deadline. And so he's reading this thing, and he's reading it in Dropbox, like in the Dropbox web app. And he was making comments. So he read the whole thing right there in the draft. I mean, start to finish, all, how many pages is that? I don't know. There, it's 225,000 words.
So yeah. Oh, yeah.
400 out of 500.
Well, yeah, but it's text. It's over, it's 530 plus pages, but that's textbook form. It's a big book.
Right. You know? And that's two columns. And that's
right.
It's two columns. And it's a big book. He read the whole thing, Dropbox, web, made comments all the way throughout.
That's wild.
He loses all of those comments. He lost it. So he doesn't know he lost it. So he contacts me. He's like, "Hey Ben, I finished it. Do you see the draft with all my comments on it?" I'm like, "Doc, it's not here. I can see the draft, but it doesn't have any comments or anything on it." He's about to have a heart attack. It's like Saturday night. No, it was Sunday night. We're now Sunday night at like 6 p.m. Sunday.
Yeah.
He's about to have a heart attack. He is not in a good mood.
Well, he's so high energy anyway. I can't imagine if he's frantic.
So this is crazy. This is crazy. He goes, "All right, I'm going to do it." He goes, "I'll have it to you by Monday morning." And he stays up all night. And he reads the whole thing again, and his comments were amazing. Like, it's not like he didn't just read this thing on the surface. I mean, you should see his comments. They were substantive. He's like, "Oh, we got to fix this. We got to add this."
Yeah.
Read the whole thing. And overnight, went to bed at like, I don't know, 5 a.m., 6 a.m. Isn't that crazy? This guy's
wild.
I can't do that.
That's amazing. You know,
It's amazing. It's just an amazing story. So he is a machine. I mean, that's why he writes so much.
Yeah.
I mean, he can work circles around guys half his age. Mm-hmm. Really, he's extreme. He's got the gift of insight and fortitude.
Right. He certainly does. And you can see why he's so prolific and produces so much scholarship at a high level.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he does.
And it's not just.
Right. He's not watching a ton of Netflix.
And it's not derivative.
No.
His stuff is not derivative. His stuff is creative. It's original. It's in-depth. The only, you know, I got really the only scholar that reminds me of him is Richard Bauckham. And there may be one other one too, but it's me because he's not derivative. He's not saying what everybody else says, but it's, I don't know. I mean, I've got tons of stories like that. It just shows you just the kind of guy he is. And it really is quite remarkable. So so the two of us did that volume for college students, and it works really well if you pair it with Carson and Moo with their NT intro. That way it hits the seminary level well. In fact, I even have guys reach out to me and to Greg that some guys read it devotionally. A lot of people use it for elder training. The guys use it in Sunday school, small groups. It's a really neat thing. I really hope it continues to do well and serves the church.
Yeah, I think it's filling a wonderful niche, an area. And obviously you, having taught in this scope, you realized what needed to be done. And so it's really scratching an itch, to use a metaphor that I think's important. Yeah. So I'm glad it's out. We'll have to talk more about it down the road. But today we're talking.
You should have me and Greg on. It'd be fun.
I'd love to. Yeah, that's the plan. We'll get to it. We got to get to this first. Or this one came out in December, From Adam and Israel to the Church: A Biblical Theology of the People of God. It's interesting here, and a lot of our listeners, our longtime regular listeners, are going to resonate with a lot of the themes addressed in here. But as you begin, just on page 2, you say that you're presenting a biblical theology from the ground up rather than the top down. What was your specific approach with this book, and what do you mean by that phrase?
So I'm obviously Reformed. I work at a Reformed seminary. I go to a PCA church.
Mm-hmm.
Most books, pamphlets, discussions of what I was trying to do there works from a very high level. It's systematic. And so the framework would, of course, be covenant theology. So that tends to work at a very high level. And so you go down, covenant works, covenant of grace, you know, So do you see it works at a synthetic level and then it goes down to the text. So I was like, look, I want to make this organic with the text. And this is why I think, and this is why I love biblical theology, because it's organic. It uses words that the Bible uses expressions and so it works from the ground up. So I try to do a ground up approach that, goes from Genesis to Revelation. Yeah. And it really is, it really started with my own lectures. And so I teach an introduction to biblical theology at RTS. And I basically just took my lecture notes and just fleshed them out. Because I didn't have a book. It's funny because most of my projects and the story we told, almost 90% of my projects come from a question somebody asks and says, "Hey, yeah. Is there a book on this?"
Right.
And I'll say, "I don't think so. There may be, but I don't think so." And so really it came out of a frustration of, I want a book that talks about the people of God, image of God, that's done at an accessible level.
Yeah. No, I think that it's definitely noticeable. I mean, that type of approach, people can pick this book up and work through it, even if they're not, initiated into all of the Reformed particulars or system of doctrine. So it should have accessibility and should be able to be read by a much wider group.
Yeah, you know, I wrote it. I wrote it thinking, can my mom understand this? Can my dad understand this? Or my brother? They go to the church, and so you need to have some grasp. But I wanted to just avoid some of the jargon and just be very plain and accessible.
At the same time, it's not lacking for depth. And of course, you mentioned even beginning on how you're building upon Dr. Beale's book, The Temple and the Church's Mission, which if people don't have a copy of that book, it's almost a must have. I'd say probably is. If you're a Reformed minister, you just got to get that book and read through it and familiarize yourself with the themes. But one of the main themes in that book is, and one of the key points is that images are tethered to God's glory in the temple and the larger program of the Bible. So what insights did you glean from Dr. Beale there, and how are you using that as kind of a principal focus or at least a launching point in this particular book?
Yeah, so one of Beale's insights in that book was he wedded image of God with temple. And I do think that some commentators and the perceptive ones sort of made that connection, but he really made that connection.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes it early on in Genesis, and he just fleshes it out in the New Testament. And so I wanted to take that angle. His focus was on the temple, not image of God per se. And so, but I wanted to look at it on the image of God in the people of God. So I highlighted that dimension. So I am indebted for him on that seminal point of relating the two. And I think he does a terrific job of it. I just, I spend more time on image of God than I do temple. I never lose focus. I never lose sight of the temple, but I do want to keep it on the image of God and people of God.
Yeah, I think that's another interesting thing, a little bit surprising, not because I don't see how it connects, but normally if I'm picking up a book, and I read a lot of books and inspect a lot of books just based on what we do here, but if you're picking up a book and you're going to read something that's like a biblical theology, maybe tending toward ecclesiology, I'm expecting a certain type of thing. If I'm reading a book on the image of God, I'm expecting more of a systematic treatment. But with this book, with connecting the ecclesiological concerns and the biblical theological concerns of the people of God, tracing it from Genesis to Revelation, in those books, you often don't get much on the image. You might get a mention of it at the beginning, but connecting those two themes and then building upon them, that is unique. And so you're correct. And I appreciate you mentioning that. And I hope our listeners will pick up on that as well, seeing that interesting connection in Dr. Beale's work. But that's something novel. I mean, not maybe that's not the right word, but it's a compelling feature of this book we don't see in others. And I think it's useful there.
Yeah, you know, I just to add some really brief, if you don't mind, there aren't many. I don't know how to say this. There aren't really all that many books on the image of God that are accessible, that are well grounded, that are biblical theological. There are a few, like Hokema's classic work, and there are some few. But typically, image of God studies are really good in the systematics, or they're very much into like the ancient Near East, or very narrow approaches. There are not many good books on the image of God, and I tell you, and the reason why I can say that is because look at how deficient the wider, the broader evangelical church is on image of God.
Yeah,
this is why we're vague. This is why the church is vague on sexuality, on work ethic, on marriage. On those are all image of God themes. If we had a robust understanding of image of God and our pastors had it and we were preaching it, we would not be vague on this issue.
Yeah. And it's something that
that's my observation.
Sure. I wouldn't disagree. I also think that seeing how significant it is such a foundational architectonic doctrine. And there are vast differences in understanding of the image, but among Reformed to Lutheran and the Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, it is such a foundational doctrine that has such great implications on the rest of the system of doctrine. We need to know and understand this at a deep biblical exegetical level and biblical theological level, which carrying that theme through a tracing of biblical theology, I think, is a very worthy endeavor on that point. And that's really what your seems to be your main concern with the volume. Is examining the nature of the people of God from Genesis to Revelation, but doing it through the lens of being made in the image of God.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Ben, you know, there are a lot of places we could start different biblical theological themes. We're looking at Genesis 1 through 3. Interestingly, most all of the books, if not all of them in this series, are picking up on at least a thread in those first three chapters of the Bible, and then seeking to develop it throughout Scripture, in a sense, kind of reminiscent of Meredith Klein and his book, Kingdom Prologue.
Right. Yeah. So I'm the editor of that series. And so I really work hard with the authors to do that. I'm like, look, we've got to start in Genesis and we've got to end in Revelation. And you would think that biblical theology volumes would do that, but most of them don't. I guess it's ironic. I don't know what the deal is.
People read the Bible atomistically often. I think that's why.
Even so. So yeah. I really tried to make it a point in that series, and I think the authors are doing it.
Well done.
So I did that. We've got some other volumes coming out here soon.
Yeah.
And they do it as well.
Yeah, that's good. I've got Michael Morales is on the shelf. I'm going to get to that soon and looking forward.
Oh, have you read it?
Not yet. I can't say that I have, but I haven't.
It's so good. It's so good. I can't say enough about it. I think you're going to love it. You're going to want to. He needs to be number 700 episode. You know what I'm saying?
I'll do it soon. I hope I could see him in a couple or next month. I'm heading down to Greenville, but looking forward to that. So, I mean, one of the themes up front then, we're talking about Eden. We've got online courses, all sorts of stuff. Our colleague here, fellow Lane Tipton's doing a lot of work on the history of heaven and Eden. Our colleague Glenn Clary's doing a biblical theology of worship and the sacrificial system. But one thing we're all talking about here is the highest heavens and also Eden as a mountain temple. And that's such an important theme. It's really new to people who haven't done the biblical theological work. It might even sound strange at first. But why is it so important for us to recognize the fact that the Garden of Eden is indeed not only on a mountain, that it's rather clear when we investigate that it is a mountain setting, but also that it's depicted as a holy place, as a temple? How does that lay the foundation for us, or at least set the correct trajectory as we start tracing these themes throughout the Bible?
Yeah. So there's a lot. I mean, that's a great question. because what it does is it helps us connect Sinai to Eden right off the bat.
Right.
I mean, Exodus even calls Sinai the mountain of God. That's God's mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Sinai itself is embodying the mountain of Eden, as it were. And so what you get then, you then have a third mountain, and that would be Mount Zion. So you really have that. Really, the trajectory would be Eden, Sinai, Zion,
mm-hmm.
and how all three of those mountains anticipate the mountain, if you want to think of it like this, the mountain of the new creation, of the new heavens and new earth. How it's in it metaphorically understood that would be a gigantic mountain. You could say that all of biblical history is bound up with four mountains.
Oh yeah.
If you wanted to synthesize it like that, it's a fascinating idea. And so what you get then, we then start to understand how humanity relates to God on these mountains. And so you have Adam and Eve, and they're on the top of this mountain on, now there's debate. It's hard for us to figure out. Is Eden the Holy of Holies, or is it the garden? There seems to be a distinction between the garden and Eden. Scholars are divided. It's not a huge point. I don't think there's any interpretive difference. It's just a matter of labels. I argue that Eden is the Holy of Holies. And then after Eden, so Eden is, yeah, so you have water that would be at the top of Eden, and it's and the water's going downwards down the mountain. And so as you descend the top of the mountain, you then hit the garden. So you have Eden at the very top. And then we don't have information. You're like, well, how far down?
Right.
We don't have that, but it goes Eden. And then there's the garden, and then past the garden would be the uninhabitable area, which is where you're going to have somewhat disorderly things.
Yeah. Analogous to the outer courts and outside
right,
the camp.
Exactly right.
Right. It makes
that's
sense because
exactly
you
right.
have
so the idea,
right?
Yeah.
The place where God is most closely identified, and then the various concentric circles moving out beyond mm-hmm. that. And we know that Eden's on a mountain from Exodus 28, but also all the rivers, four of them, are flowing mm-hmm. away from it. Mm-hmm. So it's just
flowing down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the idea then is that, well, Eden's got to come down the mountain. Adam and Eve, they're priest kings. And this is where Beale and some other Old Testament scholars say this, but well, they've got to get Eden down the mountain. They've got to plant this thing. They've got to cultivate it. They have to create images that do this temple labor, sanctuary work that will go down the mountain. You're working with creation. You're bringing order, stability. You're protecting the environment so that when, let's say, a serpent comes, you can cast out that serpent from God's presence from this mountain. And so the idea within is they would then slowly descend this mountain, and then over time they would then fill the entire earth with a garden mountain sanctuary, so that really when they successfully pull this thing off, heaven will come down. The whole goal here is that heaven will come down and God will dwell with his people. That is the telos. That is where this entire program is going. Heaven come down. So heaven and earth are two different realms, right? Well, the whole idea is that the two realms will be one realm,
yes.
That they will converge. And that's precisely what we get in Revelation 21 and 22, that there's not two different realms. There's one realm.
Amen. Yeah, complete transformation, renovation. And sometimes we think of that as merely the conclusion to the process of redemption. But as right, Gerhardus Voss right. and others indicate, I've got my cup here. Let's see here. Eschatology precedes
oh, yeah.
soteriology. So that was the plan even from the very beginning. You know, this is what Voss called the deeper Protestant conception. Adam and Eve were created for this higher, consummate, eschatological life, even prior to them falling into sin. It was the goal.
This is where image of God comes in. They're supposed to, so they're in God's image, yes, of course, but they're not in a consummated image of God. And so that's why God can't dwell with them. That's why God still is in heaven and they're on earth. And there is a divide until their image is perfected. Then God can come down. Then God can dwell with them. And of course, creation would need to be perfected too. And the animals and the entire created order needs to be perfected. Then God can come down. So really, really the driving point of the entire story is God's presence with his people. And that, of course, is achieved by Christ initially. And he will finalize it when he returns.
Absolutely. Yeah, so we see these mountains evident throughout all of Scripture, and we see them, the different mountain kind of focused on a different redemptive historical or covenantal historical era. So we have three sons of God in Scripture, at least three figures, public figures, so to speak, that are called the Son of God, Adam, clearly, and then Christ, the second and last Adam. Israel is the corporate son of God. I believe it's Exodus 4:13. It's either 4:13 or 4:23. It's in there.
Where, 4:22.
In between them.
So, close. It's all right now.
Yeah.
Versification is anachronistic.
Right. I only read from original scrolls.
That's right.
I just know the area that it's in. And so we clearly see that God is dealing with his son, and the one who is, you know, representative and image-based there. But each of those sons has a mountain that is kind of the center or the focus of worship. Eden, then we have Sinai originally, and then eventually the earthly Mount Zion. And then Christ clearly consummates all things, brings in the latter days, and his worship is focused on the heavenly Mount Zion, a la Hebrews 12, etc. So it's all tied up, and it's interesting to trace those through.
Yeah. And you know what's fascinating? So I just finished a book on the Gospels, comes out in June. And one thing that I noticed, I mean, I had seen it before, of course, but just to read it alongside Matthew, Mark, and Luke is fascinating. John really gets at this idea of Jesus being a portal. And I don't mean that like in a Stranger Things sense. I mean, it's sort of like it in that. It's analogous. It's pretty amazing. But, you know, you will see angels of God coming and, you know, coming and resting upon Jesus, you know, descending and ascending upon Jesus, the Son of Man. And then later on, we get in John's Gospel again, how Jesus is, he's the access point. Heaven and earth are converging in him. And so that's why our word portal is not a bad word to capture that reality that he is, that they have joined it. They have joined together in Jesus. He's now providing access to heaven. And that's an amazing reality there. If you think of it, Matthew's idea is more with heaven coming down. John's idea, it's the same idea, but it's more focused, more tunneled on Jesus. And so really it's this notion of a portal, which is fascinating. That's why he says stuff like, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to prepare a place for you. I'm going to finish preparing the new heavens and the new earth. I've begun it. I'm now the converging point, but I'm going to finish that process when I leave you. And the disciples aren't quite understand what that means at the moment. But it is a fascinating thing. And I really think that more work needs to be done in unpacking this in a more biblical theological manner, because the Gospels really, really start to get at this. And so what happened with dispensationalism is just threw all of this off the table, completely tabled this discussion. And so it really hasn't been until the last couple of decades when we can start having a healthy discussion of these things. And there is a lot there. It really is.
Dr. Glad, I on that note with portal, I agree. I think that that's a great a word to use. I'm having to learn Latin for my THM program right now. And don't ask me the Latin word. It's new. It's a new vocab word for me. But the word popped up and it was gate or entrance or portal. And I thought, hey, that's way of putting it. So I like that you said that. Bringing up dispensationalism, kind of want to bring that together a little bit with what you were saying earlier about this. There's this one plan, and as covenant theologians, we recognize that one plan kind of running throughout, and that was the plan from the beginning, and it runs its course through, and Christ is, of course, the fulfillment and those kind of things. But you mention a lot towards the beginning, the first few chapters of the book, about the goal for mankind, God's goal for mankind, specifically in those creational mandates or in the commission that he gives to his image bearers to go and to multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and those kind of things. You mentioned a bit about dispensationalism a minute ago. And your book wasn't a critique on dispensationalism, but you did mention, you know, some of your backgrounds in dispensationalism, and I think this book would be healthy for those. My question is, does dispensationalism lose sight of that mandate to image bearers, that creation, the commission that God gives to them as they break up history into the different strict dispensations that they have? Or do they try and focus on it in a different way? If they do, how do they do that? And how is it different from what you're stating in the book?
That's a good question. So I grew up a dispensationalist, and I was a crispy dispy really all the way through college. That's what I have to say. I'm sorry if I offended anybody, which I typically do. Because dispensationalism is so enamored with Israel, specifically ethnic Israel, the nation of Israel, well, what do you, it's the natural byproduct will be humanity, the nations, they'll catch up. That they're important, but really, we really need to talk about Israel. So do you see what happens? They don't do it. My sense is that they don't do it consciously or on purpose. It's because they're so enamored. The system is so enamored with Israel that they lose sight of humanity and what it means to be in the image of God. Do you see? That's my sense. I haven't read. I don't keep up with dispensationalism today. It's not part of my thing. I don't know if there's a whole lot going on. I don't think so. But my sense is that maybe some of the later developments in the last, maybe the 80s and 90s, maybe they'll kind of come back to this. But it was not, it's not all that on their radar, to be honest. It's not image of God. But they would only talk, and again, this is just anecdotal, but my sense is that they only talk about image of God as it relates to soteriology.
Yeah.
As it relates to image. They don't connect image of God with the purpose of the Bible. Do you see? They only relate it to systematic categories. They don't relate it to redemptive history.
Yes.
I think that's a mistake right there. And it's because in their system, it's all about Israel, all but Israel. If they put it, it really is amazing. So when I would take these Bible classes at these schools, I mean, it was like Genesis 12 was the beginning of the Bible.
Yeah.
That's the first thing you learn when you go to the Old Testament. You learn about Abraham, and it starts with the Abrahamic covenant. It's amazing. Genesis 1-3, Genesis 1-11, yeah, secondary, which is how it is.
It is, and you know, even there we see the blessing coming to the nations, and then we have passages like Galatians 3:29, Romans 9-11, all of that, Romans 4. Connection to Abraham is just somewhat lost on classic dispensationalists. Thankfully, it seems that as time moves on, there's been more of a shift where there's more of a convergence upon more biblical, theological, and reformed type ecclesiology, but it's going to take some time.
You know, with the death knell of dispensationalism, it's the use of the old and the new.
Yeah.
We have made great strides. Wow. Greg Beale is a pioneer. He really is a pioneer. He's one of probably four guys that pioneer that field. And the results of their work is the death knell of dispensationalism, because it can't hold up to the use of the only, can't hold up.
Yeah.
It cannot take the blows. Mm-hmm. and we will witness. And I think so. Tim LaHaye died, what, like 5 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that. That's a symbolic death. It really is. And I, you know, there will always be a remnant, you know, to get back to Romans 9-11. There will always be a remnant of dispensationalists, but I don't think it will ever enjoy, I think, the favor. And so what you have then is you have the decline of dispensationalism. And then coinciding with that, it's sort of the, you know, one kingdom falls and the other one rises. So what happened is now the resurgence of Calvinism among a younger group, and you guys may even be part of that. I don't know, but a younger group, people through the ministries of John Piper and ironically John MacArthur. So you really have this young, youthful desire to now read the Bible as a whole. And so now what they're looking for, because they're more Baptists, what they're now looking for is an alternative, hence progressive covenantalism. Do you see? So that's really, because they don't want to go full on reform, big R. They want to go reform, little r. So they have now produced a different, an alternative to dispensationalism. Mm-hmm. You see, that tries to be more robust.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the use of the old and the new.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. Somebody, I wish somebody would, I'm not a historian, so I'm not the guy, but I would be fascinated for somebody to map all of this out, because it has unfolded before our eyes the last 15 years, 20 years.
I agree. Okay. I think that would be a very worthy dissertation in its own right. Somebody to trace that out, or somebody who's accomplished.
Whoever it is, don't ask me to read it, at least as an advisor.
I got this idea from Ben Glad on an internet podcast.
Yeah. I give you the idea. I just don't want to.
Well, speaking of the touch points here between covenantal theology and dispensationalism, touch point being Israel, one thing you develop here is the notion of Israel as the corporate image of God. That might be new terminology to folks. I'm wondering if you could unpack that for us or explain what you mean as Israel being made in the image of God, but speaking of the corporate, the body.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are trying to get all republication on me. That's fine. Israel, Adam is a type of Israel, and Israel is a type of Christ in the church. Mm. So they are analogous, but they're typological too. I don't push as hard with Adam as being, I mean, Israel's clearly Adam, very much a corporate Adam. There's, if you read commentators in the last 30, 40 years, really from then on, even today, Old Testament commentators are making these connections. So sure. it's not just a couple of us. It's even in the wider academy. I mean,
even the Exodus 4.
It's coming to a point of major agreement that there are massive connections between Adam in the garden and Israel on Sinai. In fact, it's all across the board. It really is amazing. And so what we're trying to figure out is the precise relationship between those two. So I would say, yes, Adam is, Israel is certainly a corporate Adam. And God holds them to really the covenant of works, broadly speaking. It's not quite identical, but broadly speaking, they do. God says, hey, if you do this, you will live. You will, if you can obey this thing perfectly, you will have resurrection bodies. The new creation will descend, the earth will be recreated, transformed. God will descend. That's how I understand it. They don't do it. They can't do it. But the offer is still on the table. And so this is essentially what Jesus is doing in his ministry. Think about it. This is fascinating. The gospels spend so much time on Jesus's life. If Jesus were just trying to become a qualified sacrifice, and then they would have only given us Passion Week. They give us they are at pains. All four gospels are at pains to show that Jesus is Israel.
There's no doubt.
It's over the top.
And that he offers active obedience, and that he satisfies all the terms and fulfills all righteousness. Right. We see that in Romans 8:1-4 is so critical, I think, on this point, speaking about Christ fulfilling all the righteous requirements of the law. But it's not just in his death, it's also in his life. There's a lot of themes here just to kind of back up a little bit. I agree entirely that Israel is, you know, the corporate image of God. Israel is the son of God. In a sense, you know, the middle son, the typological son, whereas Adam's the protological son, Christ, the eschatological son. And there are tremendous overlaps and recapitulations, biblical theological themes, where Israel rehearses and repeats the history that we find in the garden with Adam. We see also Christ repeating all of those same points of history again in his own life, except he's doing it as the ultimate redeemer and savior. The point of discussion and issue for a lot of folks in our denomination, the OPC, Jeremy and my denomination, all often lends on the nature of the law and the nature of those repetitions. I don't think I don't think anyone denies the biblical theological connections and themes that are evident there, but the question relates to what is God doing with the giving of the law at Sinai and the covenantal requirements there? What's the nature of that obedience that's to be offered? For me, you know, there are many people, and I take it you're one of them from in your book, present, you know, and hold to a hypothetical view of the law that if Adam were, if Israel were hypothetically speaking able to obey and satisfy the law perfectly, then they would enter into the new heavens and the new earth, be raised imperishable, etc. I there are many Reformed people that hold that view. Not to get into a debate, I'm not one of them. I don't think Jeremy is either. But we don't have to talk about that today. The point isn't to raise this as a point of debate, but merely just a point of conversation for listeners to follow along. I tend to view the giving of the law as a pedagogue that we see clearly in Galatians. But then Galatians later on at 3:21-22, it was seeing Paul says, is the law then contrary to the promises of God? Certainly not. For if a law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law. So I connect that more or less to what you mentioned on page 48 of your book. You develop very well the total depravity, the original sin that passes down, that it's not possible for Israel to offer this perfect obedience. So then the question becomes, why did God give the law? And there are many things that we can agree on, that a lot of people can agree on, that God is giving to them his commands and his law at Sinai, so that if they obey in whatever form that would be that God is requiring, that they would retain their typological life and inheritance in the land. So whether or not there is a hypothetical view beyond the point, I'm trying to present or at least find a point of common ground here, that through obedience to the law, they would retain their life, they would live in the land, but even that land in Israel, that land in Canaan, I should say, is not the ultimate. There is the new heavens and the new earth to come. And so, again, I'm rambling, but to tie things up, I would see the law being given never, the law at Sinai, I should say, being given as a typological overlay, very Kleinian here, being given in order to offer Israel a typological life, and their obedience would be tethered to those typological blessings. Regardless of whether they offered the righteousness required, the law itself could not produce the type of life that we see in 1 Corinthians 15, Revelation 21 and 22, but that's not to say that life wasn't held out to them. It was held out to them in and through Jesus Christ, who can secure that life because he's not under the condemnation of the covenant of works. So that's a giant mouth load, but I thought I'd get that out at the point.
Right.
Of conversation.
Right. So your option is we really end up at the same place.
I think
you,
so.
What
yes.
You see as, yeah. What you see as typological, I would use the word hypothetical/typological.
Yes.
That would be the only difference between the two, as far as I can tell.
And that's how I see things.
I wouldn't want to deny typology, especially at a crucial place like this. But I would still want to say no. But there's a side of this thing, you know, Leviticus 18, do this and live. That's Jesus. Yes. I mean, but again, people debate Leviticus 18. And that's a big deal in and of itself.
And if people are interested in this one place, not the only place, but one place to go to see different approaches to this question would be the OPC study committee report on the matter.
Right.
And that's just a handy place where they've done a lot of heavy lifting and research lay these issues out, whether we have a substantial republication of the covenant of works or more biblical theological themes. Whatever we ought to say as Reformed people, at least subscribing to the Westminster Confession of Faith, that the Mosaic Covenant is an administration of the covenant of grace, and you mentioned that in the book as well, begins on a foundation of grace of the Lord bringing His people Israel out. So we're within the Reformed camps on this. That's my point. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
mm-hmm. And I think it's important to realize that there are things in Scripture, things in theology, where it's like this is vague, this is difficult right here, and this is why you can have people who can be Reformed and high on the Bible, high on inerrancy, all of these amazing things, Trinitarian, all these amazing, and yet they can differ at these points. I think even in the Westminster Confession, I think there's some vagueness.
Oh yeah.
At times over these points. So I think we've got to be like, look, this is my sense of where it's going, but I think it's wrong to be completely dogmatic on some of these that are so tricky. And you know, but that's why I do like the idea. The safe route would be to go a typological route, because you're safe on all accounts. Everything is you see that you're able to sort of satisfy all the major pieces of the puzzle here and stay robustly biblical.
Well, one way or the other, I see a definite and a healthy insistence on following eschatology from the beginning to the end. Eschatologies ought not to be considered merely as some addendum or only millennial views that, and you know, you can pick and choose whichever one you like the best. But eschatology, more broadly considered, maybe we would blend this in with the realm of teleology, you know, the purpose and the direction or the goal to which all of the Bible is moving. That's something that you're carrying on throughout the Bible. I love that about this book. But it's also a place where I see so many evangelicals as it's an opportunity to grow. I wonder if you might speak to evangelicals and in a way, and what would you say to some who might not understand or even see the importance of tracing the eschatology and teleology throughout Scripture? Why is it important to expand our notion of that beyond just the last two or three chapters of the Bible?
Yeah, because because scientism, materialism rules the day, right? Scientism, the way that it's articulated by so many people in our culture, in the West especially, is, hey, it's got to follow the science. Well, the problem is that science is self-correcting, and what was scientific 3 years ago is rubbish today. So that's a problem. The other problem is that science can't tell us anything about why we're here. Can't tell us anything really about how we got here, which is ironic because that is what it's trying to do, but it can't do that. So the Bible, Christianity, can tell us origins. It can tell us, I was just telling my students yesterday, like, the thing about the Bible, it can tell us where we came from. It can tell us who we are, what we're supposed to do today, how we got here. And guess what? It's going to tell us where we're going. So the problem has been within wider evangelicalism, I'm unsure about the Reformed camp here, but when wider evangelicalism, so much time is spent on origins, that's not a bad thing, but that's just looking back. Mm-hmm. We've got to get it right looking forward. So we have to be able to tell the culture, look, God created me. God created the world. You don't create anything. You can't even tell your body not to die. you can't wish your heart to keep going. You can't wish your breath to keep moving. No, you can't. You're not a creator. God created us. We're in His image. We are His. Number two, We are fashioned after his son. We know what we're supposed to do today. Prophet, priest, and king. We got to work it out. And then it also tells us where everything is going. And so when you start to get this robust view of the past, the present, the future, you can solve so many of these pressing issues. It really puts things in perspective so that when your house hypothetically, if your house catches fire, you lose everything.
Yeah, in case that might happen. Yeah.
In case that might happen. You know what? You move into a rental and you just keep going, right? Because I can make sense of things that happen to us, because the Bible tells me how to think about it, how they contextualize it. And we have to reassure. The problem is that we have to remind ourselves of these things on a daily basis, right? We're only, you know, we're inaugurated new creation. So we've got to remind ourselves. I think in the new creation, I think we won't have as much memory loss as we do today on a daily basis. So yeah, it's really, I think it's really pressing that we understand what the Bible's trying to do, because just what's happening with, you know, the culture, you guys get it. I don't need to keep preaching the choir. So
yeah, it's not looking good culture wise. Yeah.
I think it's good, but I think in some sense, I like it because
it's clarifying,
because Christianity is so different. That's Christianity is so refreshing. Like it's amazing. We can not solve all these problems, but we can give amazing answers. And people are, I think what's happening is that even pagans are realizing that scientism is not giving them good answers. And I think they're getting frustrated with it. Mm. And I think what happened with COVID is they're like, look, I thought this is sort of 100 years ago before the wars. They were like, oh, we are amazing. We got science. We got health. We can do anything. And then when the pandemic hits and you're like, well, science is going to have to take a while to sort this out. We still don't know. It's frustrating to people because it's like, look, I've worshiped science and science isn't helping.
Yeah.
Frustrating. It's frustrating to unbelievers.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and the lines are more sharply drawn and
the hope of the gospels. It's a good thing. It's a very good thing.
You did a good job, I think, drawing out how the common curses, kind of going back to some of the first chapters, but drawing out how the common curses given to the man and the woman at the fall affected those creational mandates or the commission given to man. Tell us a little bit about how the fall affected our commission as image bearers.
Very pointedly, we don't want to spread God's glory, right? So if we're supposed to spread God's glory and God made us to do that, but what the fall is going to be the opposite of it. So we don't spread God's glory, we spread our glory. So even unbelievers, it's amazing, even unbelievers are in the image of God. That is a significant piece of theology. Mm-hmm. But what I tried to put my finger, and this is where I'm a sort of a creative guy. And so I like to kind of work some things out that haven't always been worked out. So I argue that unbelievers are in God's image. That's very traditional. But what's, I think, somewhat untraditional is that I start to then argue, well, even unbelievers, they're a prophet, priest, and king. Okay. If that's true, if being in the image of God is being a prophet, priest, and king, well, they're not doing it the right way, are they? It's their prophet that's instead of subduing sin, they subdue unrighteousness. They subdue righteousness, right? They subdue believers. They, in other words, they're wicked kings. These are their wicked kings. They're priests. So a priest is supposed to rid area of defilement. Well, what's the opposite of that? They're defilers.
Yeah,
they're defilers. And then prophets, well, instead of being the voice of God, what do? You're the voice of Satan. You're the voice of you know, deceit. So those things just get worked out, I think, on a daily basis. The Old Testament itself, especially in the later, and especially in the apocalyptic books, I'm thinking here of Daniel, they do use, now broad understanding here, but they do use categories of the image of God when talking about a coming Messiah and also a coming antagonist, which we will later call the Antichrist. In other words, think about it. The Old Testament actually does it. So the Old Testament does anticipate a Messiah, but what I try to do is connect Messiah to image of God early on. And I think that's an important thing. So if you, what's fascinating here is that, so I think the Old Testament itself would argue that the coming Messiah is not just a king, which obviously does very explicitly, and not just a priest, which I think we can also argue is explicit in some texts, but then also a prophet. So a prophet, priest, and king. So the Messiah is going to wrap up all three of these into one. Now, there are some portions of Judaism that actually anticipated two Messiahs, a king and a priest. But Jesus is going to wrap all three of these offices into one person. And I think a responsible reading of the Old Testament demonstrates that. And I would argue, on the other hand, an antagonistic figure does the opposite. This antagonist is, and I call him an anti-king, yeah, an anti-priest, and an anti-prophet. So do you see, we have two individuals in the latter days who they actually converge in some of these texts, and they are doing opposite things. It's a fascinating idea.
Yeah.
I think I love that one.
Yeah, tracing those themes was really wonderful, you know, to see that anti-image and that conflict at work. But, you know, to flip that, we also see the passing on of the holy, glorified, righteous image of Christ to his people, clearly in 1 Corinthians 15, but also in many other ways. You have several chapters where you're developing the idea of the church as kings, the church as priests, the church as prophets. How does Christ then, as the perfect image of God, firstborn over all creation, you know, Colossians 1, 15 through, you know, 20-ish for that Christ hymn, how does Christ then inaugurate the latter days, usher in the new creation, and then change his people, you know, by the Spirit, so that Christ becomes firstborn of many brothers, a la Romans 8, 29?
You know, so I did a paper at ETS this past November. It was virtual. I don't know if anybody even watched it. I mean, the other panelists had to, but I argued that there in Acts 1 and Acts 2 with Pentecost, Luke is presenting Pentecost at the beginning of the church in Adamic terms. And there's notions like, in fact, commentators have noticed pieces of this thing with wind, this notion of wind in Genesis 2:7, and picking it up with Ezekiel. And there are these, but I tried to put all the pieces together, and the way, and I do some of this in the book, and I wish I could rewrite one of the chapters there, because I think I could make it clear. Pentecost is a massive event. That's when it's Genesis 1 and 2 all over again, but this time it's restored, and this time there's no going back. And it's when the church is a restored Adam figure, and it is just amazing. And I think Luke really presents it as such. And I think if you just read Acts, even as it unfolds, you see the church is now doing Adamic things, a prophet, priest, and king. And I think it really is marvelous. And I think it starts with Pentecost and some of the pieces. If you read the text closely, you start to pick up on some of these Adam pieces, and you put them all together. I'm like, this is it. This is creation again. And I think Luke is very attentive to those things. And so really what you get in Paul, this is amazing. What you get in Paul is just an assumption that that's happened. Paul doesn't really get in, or I don't think he does get into when it started. He just assumes that it's true. Do you see?
Yeah.
Acts tells us when it happened. Mm-hmm. Paul just says it's true. Therefore, go and da da da. Do you see that? So the answer here is Pentecost.
Yeah, it was eye-opening for me when I was introduced to the idea of Pentecost and reading it redemptive historically and corporately. Very much indebted I am to the work of Richard Gaffin on this, especially with his book Perspectives on Pentecost. But a lot of evangelicalism, especially, you know, the charismatic variety, you end up reading or understanding Pentecost as something that belongs to the area or the domain of Ordo Salutis, that is, things that ought to happen to me as an individual in my Christian life. Now, clearly the Spirit does touch us as individuals in the Christian life, but it's insofar as we're incorporated into the people of God, that we're united to Christ and part of that. So when we see the pouring out of the Spirit, this is the fulfillment of Christ mentioning that when he goes, he's going to send a helper, a comforter. But this is a climactic event in the history of the people of God that brings them into a new era. Now they've received their promised inheritance that Paul's been talking about in Galatians 3, that the law has done its job in the sense of being a pedagogue and tutor to lead people up to maturity. But now they're receiving everything that was pointed forward to in the first place. And then through Christ and through the Spirit, again, Romans 8, 1 through 4, Christ has satisfied and fulfilled the righteous requirements of the law, both in dying so that the penalty of sin is no longer upon us. The guilt and wrath and condemnation that came from the covenant of works is no longer there. It's been satisfied and we've received Christ's righteousness. But also, as Paul mentions, and again, it's in the background, Pentecost here, but the Holy Spirit moves us to walk in newness of life. So we're fulfilling the righteous requirement of the law. God is fulfilling the righteous requirement of the law in and through his people by the Spirit working in and through them to do that which is pleasing to him. So we're law keeping. We are image bearing in the sense of being proper prophet, priests, and kings by the enablement now, the equipment of the Spirit, which is totally new. And so Pentecost can no longer be repeated any more than the resurrection, than the death and resurrection of Christ could be repeated. That's a climactic once for all event for the people of God.
Life changing. That's exactly right. And don't forget that the way Luke and I think all the gospel writers, when they present Jesus at the Jordan River, that's Pentecost. Mm. That's a personal Pentecost. Mm. And so then think about it. So then so you've got Luke, Acts, right? Two volume project. So Luke is going to begin his first volume with Jesus, personal Pentecost. Then what does he do? Second volume, corporate Pentecost. Yeah. Because Jesus succeeded as Adam in Israel, he then now fashions a corporate people through the Spirit. You see that? And I think those are nice. Those are, especially in Luke Acts, those are held together as parallel notions. That's very important. And this is exactly what you're talking about.
I love this. So to connect, you know, Genesis again to where we started, as well as to what you mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15, we have here a redemptive historical era of, in a sense, the church not entering into consummation yet because we haven't been raised imperishable because Christ has not yet returned. He will. But often when we read 1 Corinthians 15 and we see that through the resurrection, Christ becomes life-giving Spirit, we might tend to read that as purely a future event, just waiting for our resurrection from the body to become, you know, spirit mode livers. But there's this era in which we live, this inaugurated eschatology, even already. So to pick up the threads that you just laid out, and I think it very insightfully, when Christ is baptized, he is being, in a sense, ordained to the office of Messiah. Mm-hmm. But then at Pentecost, it's not that we're being ordained as the church into the office of Messiah, but we're, in a sense, being recreated in this new Spirit image with a Spirit equipment of God. So we have that. Christ has already, there's an aspect in which Christ has already become life-giving Spirit for us. But when we're raised as the greater harvest of which he's the first fruits, it will be the fullness. I love that. That's
right.
So good.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well done, Ben. I mean, we kept you already 24 minutes over the time we promised.
But it's fun to hang out. Fun to hang out. I'm just jealous of all your books at home.
Well, yeah, most of my books are at the office too, and we know that your library was mostly spared.
Yeah, it's okay.
Because you have it at RTS. But You got to see this room they've got at Puritan Reformed, because they have a rare book room, but they have this speaking of HVAC, they have this HVAC system where if there's a fire, not only does that room get locked, but it deploys a special gas and it evacuates all oxygen from the room. So the so that the rare books don't burn.
Oh man.
So the last place you want to be.
I've been in that room. It's nice. I didn't know that it was Mission Impossible. Like
that is the last place in the world I think you want to be if there's a fire.
That's a good one.
You are not going to be breathing. Yeah. So
that's funny. That's
spare
funny.
The books, not the people. Anyway, Ben, it's been a joy to speak with you, catch up on both of these books. Of course, get a copy of The Story Retold. We'd love to talk about this not too far down the road. We'll get to that soon.
Yes, biblical of course.
Absolutely. And then From Adam and Israel to the Church, A Biblical Theology of the People of God. There's so much here. This is the kind of book you could read five times and always be picking up new things in a good sense. It's a well done book. I appreciate the effort, and thank you also for editing the whole series and for taking the time to speak with us today. It's been a true pleasure.
Oh yes, of course. Yeah. Thank you.
You bet. So head on over to rts.edu. You get information about what's going on at the seminary system. A lot of good work there. They've also got a faculty podcast, at least for the folks over in Washington. So they gotta steal you over there. I know there's some crossover sometimes with the Orlando folks, but they only seem to go south. They don't seem to go as far west. We're gonna make a public appeal to the Washington guys to get some of these Jackson guys over.
That's right. And it's ironic. It's ironic because I'm from DC.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they'll have you on soon enough, no doubt. You'll be coming home to your stomping grounds. And, of course, we're online at reformedforum.org. You'll be able to find information about our free online programs that we have, courses, new publications in the works, all of our programs and everything. And you can get a hold of us either through Twitter, the contact form on the website, or send us an email. All the information for those things is available on the website. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.